We'll do the trouser press, baby. One, two, three.
Welcome to the Rock's Back Pages podcast. I'm Barney Hoskins and I'm in London, England with my colleagues and RBP co-founders, Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And Martin Collier.
Hello, Barney.
And joining us for this episode, all the way from Brooklyn, New York, is Mr. Ira Robbins. Hi, Ira.
Barney and Martin and Mark.
Hi.
Great to see you. Ira requires no introduction to the cognoscenti of American rock journalism, but we welcome him today because it's the 50th anniversary of the launch of the splendidly named Transoceanic Trouser Press, which by, I think, early 1976 had become simply Trouser Press. And Ira, you've marked the occasion of the magazine's 50th by anthologizing some of the best articles and interviews that appeared in its 96 issues. The book is called Zip It Up, The Best of Trouser Press Magazine, 1974 to 1984, and it's absolutely terrific. Now, since for a while, Trouser Press bore the hilarious strapline, America's Only British Rock Magazine, can you tell us when and how your musical anglophilia began?
Well, I was a folk music kid, you know, protest music, and introduced to Bob Dylan at a very young age by a neighbor. And then, of course, the Beatles. I was 9 years old, and it completely overturned my view of everything. But after that, you know, I kind of like followed along with AM radio. I listened to WMCA in New York, and that was as much the Supremes and the Beach Boys as it was the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. But then, I guess in 1967 or so, I discovered The Who. And that was kind of the nail in my anglophiliac coffin, in a positive sense.
A positive coffin.
Yeah, a good coffin.
I mean, as positive as a coffin can be.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, that kind of like changed my view that sort of that England is where the music that I cared about was coming from, you know. And at that point, you know, I started discovering, I sort of went down the rabbit hole, you know, for other British bands. You know, I'm still interested in a certain amount of American music, but, you know, the San Francisco psychedelia did nothing for me. The folk music stuff kind of got boring by then, so I wasn't really interested in what Tom Paxton or Joan Baez was doing. And it just became kind of like my obsession. And then, you know, in high school, I met Dave Schultz, who became my best friend and the co-founder, one of the three co-founders of Trouser Press. And we just kind of became Who fanatics together, and it kind of led from there. You know, we became genealogists for British music by discovering that the library in New York had a microfilm collection of melody makers going back to the 40s. And so we started researching a project that Dave initiated of basically trying to do a genealogy of every British rock musician we could find mentioned in anywhere.
It's a wonderful story. I mean, did you feel a bit like it was just sort of two of you kind of against, I don't know, against the world, these two British music obsessives? Were there other people who, you know, who hadn't become Anglophiles after the Beatles first came to America? I mean, did you feel very alone in your Anglophilia?
No, not in our Anglophilia. We felt alone in our Who fandom. You know, the Who in 1968, 69, 70 were not well appreciated in America. I mean, Tommy did a lot for them, but up until Tommy, they were pretty reviled. You know, they were the hooligans from England who broke guitars and who liked their crap anyway. They had no hit records in America. I mean, Happy Jack was their biggest hit, and it wasn't even a big hit. You know, so My Generation did nothing here. I Can't Explain did nothing here. You know, so liking The Who was very much an underground concept. And, you know, we saw them in the Monterey film and were completely knocked out because we hadn't seen them in person yet. And, you know, so that was kind of the focus for us. But, you know, what we became was sort of aficionados of like the details of British rock. It wasn't so much that the bands that we liked were not popular. They just weren't really known here, you know, but we just became kind of focused on like what people had done before they did the things that they were known for. But there were plenty of Anglophiles in New York. The whole, you know, the beginnings of the New York underground scene, bands like The Fast and The Planets and The Marbles and stuff, they were all, you know, pretty British oriented, you know, right. Very much Kinks, Hollies. You know, I mean, I had a band in 1975 and we played Look Through Any Window by The Hollies, you know, and that was not completely unheard of.
That's wonderful. And I mean, you, at a certain point after you're researching in the Lincoln Center Library, I mean, you started reading the British Inkies, and they would make their way over the Atlantic very, very slowly. I think sort of coiled in these sort of tubes, if I've read one of the interviews with you correctly. So they'd arrive, yeah, how much later would they finally wash up on the shores?
Well, they came by sea mail, I guess 8 weeks to 10 weeks, perhaps. You know, and they, as you say, they came rolled in brown paper, kind of like a sausage, you know, like they were a tube, right? You know, like,
and, you know, and would and, you then, the sausage would arrive and you'd call Dave and say, it's arrived. The new issue's here.
We bring it into school. We took a class in our, I guess our senior year. It was a chemistry class, and they had these big stone hoods to keep from like poisoning ourselves. They were, you know, exhaust hoods, and you worked underneath them so that the, you know, the fumes went up into an exhaust. And they were excellent for like hiding from the teacher what we were doing, which was reading Melody Maker. So I would bring it into class, and we would like open it up surreptitiously behind these big, you know, boxes that we were hidden behind. Yeah, so we went over that stuff pretty carefully. And then, you know, I think one of us subscribed to the NME as well. It was always the NME and Melody Maker for us, although Dave, yeah, and Jim Green ended up writing for Sounds. Yeah, so Sounds became part of our world. But in the early days, before Trouser Press, it was definitely MM and NME.
And you liked Roy Hollingworth, didn't you? One of the key Melody Maker writers. And I believe later ran into him when he moved to New York as sort of their correspondent there.
I don't think I knew him before I don't think I knew of him before he moved to New York. He was like the MM's guy in New York. And, you know, we were kind of fascinated because he was a, you know, a British journalist, you know, and there weren't, yeah, many rock journalists even in those days that we knew. But yes, I met him, I think, at the Hawkwind party. There's this legendary Hawkwind party that Susan Blonde convened at the Planetarium, oh, after the show. And it was just this star-studded event that went on for like all night. I mean, they served breakfast. It was that long. I mean, it was that kind of a party. Like at like 4 or 5 in the morning, we had like champagne and eggs. And I was like maybe 19 or 20 years old and completely like overwhelmed by all this excitement. It was just completely mad. But Roy was there and I met him and we were kind of like, hey, we're big fans. And, oh, you know, like, I don't remember anything else about the meeting, but, you know, Alice Cooper was at that thing and Richard Meltzer and Stevie Wonder, I believe. And it was just a completely nutty party.
Sounds wonderful.
Who knew Stevie Wonder was a Hawkwind fan?
The hell was Stevie doing at a Hawkwind party?
I have no idea.
That's brilliant.
It was a nice party. I mean, you know, it was a big whoop. You know, if you were town, you went to this party.
Yeah, wonderful. Were you already writing at that point? Had you written, I believe you wrote for like Good Times magazine, and then we've got early pieces by you, like from Zoo World and things like that.
First thing I started doing was my college paper. I was in engineering school in New York, and we had this tiny, crappy college paper. And when I put my hand up and said I'd like to write about music, they said, sure. And so I did, and I wrote a bunch of stuff for that paper. That was starting in, I guess, 73, late 72, early 73. And then I got a record review in Good Times, which was my first paying journalism. I got $3 or $4 for it. It was a review of a Doug Somm Bits and Pieces album that Paul Nelson had assembled, and I was completely awful in my review. I was like, it's an absolutely shameful piece of writing, but what did I know? And then, you know, from there, I was submitting stuff to Cream, got a very nice rejection letter from Lester Bangs that hangs in my cellar, and Zoo World was like the first magazine that kind of took me seriously, and so Arthur Levy, who was the editor there in Florida, let do stuff. And so I started doing record reviews and the occasional concert review for them. And that was all around the time the Trouser Press thing started.
So was the idea for like doing a magazine kind of germinating away under the surface as you were freelancing for these publications?
Yeah. I mean, that just kind of, Trouser Press kind of popped up kind of accidentally. Dave and I went to a guy's house in Yonkers who was a Kinks fanatic. And he just kind of got like a record collector gang together to like talk about records, which I don't really understand why he did it, but he did it. And Dave and I went, and I think we met Alan Betrock there, who was a legend at the time. And there was a guy called John Overall, who was a big collector. I don't remember who else was there, but we met this woman, Karen Rose, who was a Jeff Beck fanatic. And we just got talking to her, and she'd been the editor of the Brooklyn College newspaper. She was a few years older than us and actually had a real job in the real world. And Dave and I were still in college. And we just kind of got the idea that we would start a magazine together, basically because we were all hoping to write and didn't really have the kind of access to national publications that we thought we would like to be writing for. And it just sort of seemed like a shortcut, right, to just do it yourself. So we agreed to do it. It just kind of germinated for a couple of months. And then around the end of the year, 1973, we decided to do it. And Karen and I had a long conversation talking about names of the magazine. And we finally hit on Trouser Press based on the Bonzo song. We had a bunch of horrible names thought of that thankfully were forgotten. One of them was actually called like the Ro-Ro Times based on our last names, which would have been just really, we would not be sitting here today if the magazine had started as the Ro-Ro Times.
How long into it did it become your full-time job? And did you have a kind of a feeling that, oh, this could go on for a few years? Did you ever feel settled and secure?
Yeah, we did eventually. But when we started, we did one issue, not really thinking if we were going to do a second one. You know, we flogged them in front of a concert hall at a Rory Gallagher concert, just to sort of like, that was our big plan, because we had an article about Rory Gallagher in the first issue. It took a while. I mean, our first office was a post office box at Grand Central. And then we moved into a bagel shop in the West Village for a while. And then we used to mail subscriptions from Karen's flat on Fifth Avenue. And it wasn't for a while. We got maybe a year in, we got an office, a very small one room office, and then got a two room office a year after that. And then it was about 4 years in or so that I quit my part time job and became full time at Trouser Press. At that point, you know, we saw it as an ongoing thing, you know, but up till then it was a little bit like day to day.
Yeah. Did you become a kind of stop in New York for British bands touring?
Not really. More for British journalists on Liggs.
Of course.
Yeah. You know, I mean, two of your best became writers for us, Paul Rambali and Pete Silverton, both of whom have sadly died within the past year. But they both found us very early on and began writing for us. And, you know, both went on to excellent careers in, you know, in mainstream British music journalism, Pete at Sounds and Paul at the NME and then The Face. They would just like come over like at the drop of a hat. I mean, like some American company would have some horrible band playing in Kansas City and they would fly everybody from London over for it. And like, so we would just be sitting there and the door would open and there'd be one of our British correspondents strolling in going, oh yeah, you know, we're on our way to Kansas City to see Styx or some horrible thing, you know? And it was just like, we were jealous because we didn't get Liggs, you know, but if they were on staff at a weekly, they just could basically go anywhere they wanted, whenever they wanted.
Yeah.
I wanted to read just a sentence from the interview you did with rockcritics.com in 2001 with Stephen Ward. You say, "We loved Cheap Trick, The Who, Roy Wood, Sparks, Todd Rundgren, and The Clash. We hated Bruce Springsteen and all the manly Americans who bellowed rather than sang."
Wow.
Do you stand by that?
Absolutely, 100%.
I mean, so you did. There's room, obviously, for some Americans in there, but not manly Americans.
Well, I mean, you know, the cock rock kind of left us cold. I mean, we always sort of gravitated towards clever and sardonic and kind of underdoggy, you know, even if they were successful. So, I mean, obviously, you know, a lot of stuff happened that wasn't included in that brief sentence that we cared about one way or the other. But yeah, I mean, the first American band that really I loved, you know, passionately besides Bob Dylan was The Band, and they weren't even American, but, you know, for a time.
well, a tiny bit American.
One-fifth American. For a time, The Band were like the Godhead for me because of their embrace of what I thought American music could be about, you know, which was sort of about America, not about, you know.
I think this is something we all four of us share.
Yes.
Yeah. But would you not say the band were quite manly? and certainly very hirsute. They were certainly hirsute.
But they didn't bellow.
They didn't bellow. Thank you, Martin. That's it.
Or wear over tight trousers.
No.
Okay, I get it now.
But yeah, I mean, there were certainly American bands we liked. And, you know, of course, the complicating factor for us was the New York scene because, you know, we were in it. We loved it. We were like fans of it, but we weren't writing about it for a while because we fancied ourselves being an international magazine. I mean, we had, you know, we had copies and compendium books and, you know, in North London. So how could we write about New York when no one could see those bands? You know, the thing for us was that at the time that the New York scene really heated up, those bands didn't have labels. They didn't have records. They didn't have touring plans. They played New York. And so we were self-conscious about, you know, the elitism of writing about a band that, you know, most of our readers would have no way of hearing. And so we saw ourselves as being like too generous to actually write about these bands that we loved. So no television, no Ramones, no Blondie, no Heartbreakers, no Talking Heads, you know. And then we finally sort of wised up, I guess, around the time, just around the same time that Alan Bettrock started the New York Rocker, which was the inverse concept, which was, you know, everything in New York is important.
Only and
you know, you're going to have to come here and find out about it. And at that point, we started doing these sort of like tepid, timid, grudging, like, here's these bands we like that we know you can't hear, but, you know, maybe you'll find out about them. You know, maybe we'd like to tell you about them anyway. And that was sort of like where the American music that we cared about a lot was really coming from like the local scenes. You know, it was Devo and it was the, you know, it was the Pretenders and it was, you know, 415 bands like Romeo Void and Translator. And it was, you know, Texas and, you know, Seattle, like the Wipers, you know, so it was those bands that really fired us up, you know, because as American music.
Sure.
Just to step back a couple of years before that, I know you were keen on glam or glitter rock, as it was more commonly known on your side of the pond. And you later wrote a novel called Mark Bolan Killed in Car Crash. So you're still very fond of the glam era. I wanted to point out to listeners that, you know, you've been on Rock's Back Pages for a long time. We're, you know, eternally grateful to you for that. We've got a lot of your pieces and we've got a good number of your audio interviews. And we thought it might be amusing in this connection just to hear a brief snippet from the interview you did in 1975 with Steve Harley of Cockney Rebel.
You see, in England, it's very bigoted. Mm-hmm. And they're more bigoted than I am, you know. And they're very silly little boys, very hung up, mm-hmm. the reporters. And they're very hung up, very silly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not all true what they say about me.
Well, you have to realize, like, I'm coming from a perception of American journalism first. You know, I mean, I'm more familiar with American journalism. And I more or less turned to British writing because I found it vastly superior to what comes out of America. I mean, there have been good publications and good writers in America, but generally, I mostly run into writing that's self-indulgent to the point of not caring about music, whereas the redeeming feature that I find in British writing is that no matter how much they might like slag an artist and call Brian Ferry, you know, Brandt Ferrari, or call you... you know, cucky rabble or whatever they like to call you, you know.
There's only one comic you're talking about, and believe me, that's a comic.
The enemy?
It's a sixth form sense, schoolboy sense of humour. Mm. It's regressive, it's backwards, it's retarded. The whole of that staff is still into cheap rock and roll boogie.
Well,
they don't understand modernism in any way at all. They're very behind their time.
I mean, it was fascinating listening to you asking that question and saying what you said back in 1975. And also just to bear in mind that, you know, Cockney Rebel had just scored their first, like, number one hit at that point with Make Me Smile. You'd think he'd be slightly less peevish.
Oh, it was an interesting moment because, you know, he was one of the first of the vanguard of British pop stars who couldn't get arrested in America. You know, I mean, he was a huge star in England and he played the bottom line, you know, on a weeknight in New York. So, you know, to what, 600 people, you know, so I think he was shocked by the fact that he wasn't anybody famous here. I think he was also extremely gratified that someone cared about him, which I did. You know, I actually thought he was quite talented and charming in his own sort of patronizing, condescending, egotistical way. But what really struck me, you know, in reading that transcript was that he seriously cared about what I thought, which, you know, was ridiculous. Because in 1975, I was the publisher of a magazine that had a circulation of what, 3,000, maybe 2,000, you know, like I was nobody, you know, in the context of his career. Yet he was very interested in what I had to say and was very grateful that I had listened carefully to his record. You know, the funny thing was the NME, which he was attacking here, ended up quoting that interview. They published that line from that interview in the NME later.
Did they? Okay. Okay. Worth pointing out that that interview is included in Zip It Up, the anthology that I mentioned earlier. It's in the section entitled The Glory of Glam. And there's also a piece about Brian Eno by Paul Rambali in there. I just want to mention a couple of other, you know, things that I remember reading or have read since we started Rock's Back Pages. There's an early piece about Small Faces by Pete Silverton. There's a cover story that Chris DiLorenzo wrote about Syd Barrett. There's Dave Schultz's very, very long, I mean, like three-part, I think, interview with Jimmy Page. David Frick's great piece about Todd Rundgren, From Here to Utopia, which I remember, and lots of other amazing things. And pieces by, you know, I think one of the things you say or have talked about is that, you know, you did have quite a, you had a pretty decent number of women writers on Trouser mm-hmm. Press. Do you want to just talk about that for a second?
Absolutely. You know, it was not a plan. I mean, there was never a thought at the time that we needed to have, you know, more equitable representation in the journalism side of things. We just worked with whoever came to us that we thought was talented, you know, and the magazine was co-founded by a woman. A lot of the writers were women. And, you know, it never occurred to us that there was an issue there. You know, I mean, we were young and desperate to have, you know, people who would fill our pages with stuff that we could be proud of. And, you know, if it was women or men, it made zero difference to us. So, you know, it kind of shocked me a little bit, like as time went on, and the perception kind of solidified that women were, you know, brutally excluded from music journalism, because that was never really true. You know, certainly women were probably mistreated in music journalism. I remember, you know, stories from women writers that I knew about, you know, being presumed to be groupies by the artists that they were interviewing and being hit on and being, you know, treated poorly. And so absolutely women were not given, you know, the same shake that men were in terms of dealing with artists. But, you know, in terms of making opportunities available for women to write about music, you know, it seemed to me that they existed. It was just a question of women finding, you know, a voice that they could bring to bear, you know, and as long as, you know, I don't want to sound like Jan Winter here, but, you know, like if women wanted to write for Trouser Press, we were fine listening to them.
Yeah. So we have, in addition to some of Chris DiLorenzo's pieces, we also have Toby Goldstein on Rock's Back Pages and Karen Schlossberg. So it's just worth mentioning that. Another of the pieces that made the cut in the book, Ira, is about Nick Lowe by Scott Eisler. Nick Lowe's Wonderful World of Pop. And that ties in quite neatly with the fact that we have an audio interview with the great Nick Lowe by yourself. So Mark is going to just tell us a bit about this, and hopefully we'll be able to listen to some clips from that.
Yes, absolutely. It's a lovely interview for a start. I mean, he's such a nice person. You know, he's a lovely man. He talks about such things as not feeling really part of the pop business. And we can listen to the first clip, which is about that sort of little window when a whole bunch of those bands like Rockpile and so on actually were sort of starting to have near hit records, whilst always being slightly outside of that particular loop. Let's have a listen.
Well, you were very collegial in the 70s. I mean, there was a whole sense of this kind of like group of like-minded British musicians. I mean, Dave and Elvis, and, you know, the Reckless Erics. And all the people you produced. I mean, because it was kind of like, from this vantage point, it very much seemed as if you were the center of this kind of very groovy club of, like, you know, really thoughtful, adult, kind of conscientious musicians who were mindful of American music.
Yes, it's kind of you to say so, and I think you're probably right. But even then, they were all sort of outsiders, you know. They weren't. It was even then. I mean, it's the one time when the what's the opposite of mainstream? Is there an opposite?
Fringe.
All right, when the Fringe suddenly became the mainstream, right. For only for about 2 weeks. You know.
But what a 2 weeks
it was! It was a fabulous 2 weeks, yeah. But so even then, you know, it was all a bunch of. It was wonderful when that happened, because suddenly it was the monkeys were running the zoo, you know, just for a brief time. You gotta be cruel to be kind in the right measure. Cruel to be kind, that's a very good sign. But cruel to be kind means that I love you, baby.
Great. So he's brilliant. This is on the back of his latest album called At My Age. And he talks about his songwriting processes, his love of 50s to 70s American music. His love of American music sort of stopped somewhere around sort of 1978, I suspect. But wanting to make records which sounded handmade. This was at a time when machines had really taken over. He talks about writing songs with Chrissie Hynde, who's an old friend of his. He talks some length about his relationship with Elvis Costello. Of course, his production of This Year's Model, which is one of the great sounding records I've ever heard in my life. You know, at my age, the record is essentially about growing old, and he talks interestingly about that. So let's have a listen to that.
Well, I've had a pretty good innings, you know. I on paper, I've had a couple of hits. I've produced some pretty good records for other people, written some good songs, things like that. But why am I now on the scrap heap when I don't think I've actually done very much at all?
Mm-hmm.
And so I started thinking about this and thinking that whereas now it's different, of course, but back then. Unlike jazz or blues or in country and western back then, you couldn't be too old,
right.
You know. That didn't exist in pop music. Uh-huh. And so I started trying to figure out a way I could represent myself and use the fact that I was aging in this business as a distinct advantage, you know, and to be the opposite from what it usually is if you're trying to bother. Sort of feebly try and hide it.
Right.
Take a look before they close the book. At the other side of the coin.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's an interesting conversation because no one really prophesied that pop musicians would have lengthy careers, and it's still an endless issue. When the Rolling Stones are touring again at the age of, sort of 75 or 82 or whatever it is, you know, it's a very moot point. And he goes on, he talks about producing records, and he talks very generously about his ex-wife, Carlene Carter, and about Johnny Cash, and Johnny Cash covering his songs, and Johnny Cash dragging him on stage at the Albert Hall to sing along with him. Much to his resistance, he's very funny about it. Barney and I were talking about, you know, do we love Nick Lowe before? And, you know, as a singer, not terribly, but as a songwriter, definitely very strong songwriter and a wonderful producer. And I think just a kind of a good guy.
All around good guy. Ara, before we ask you about your memories of that interview and your thoughts generally about Nick Lowe, just wanted to ask Martin where he stands on Nick Lowe.
Oh, do we have to stand somewhere?
No, you can sit. You can sit. You can lie down.
I've always really liked Nick Lowe's stuff. It's interesting because they're incredibly well made, his records.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much all of them, and they've never been not well made. It's a career of really well made, well judged, literate, intelligent songwriting with a kind of warmth that I think, I don't know, it's just it. I never was drawn to buying lots of Nick Lowe's records. I saw him either when he supported or when they supported him. Dan Penn and Spooner Oldham toured, and Nick Lowe was the other part of the bill.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed it. He plays with very good music. Geraint Watkins, he has a very good little musical group
around him in Southwest
London. Yeah, I mean, a journeyman of the best kind, I think.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a nice term. Yes. So Ira, what do you remember interview? I mean, that wasn't so long ago. It was 2007. And he's already talking about feeling old, and that's nearly 20 years ago. God, it made me feel old. So, yeah, tell us about, you know, just Nick Lowe in general and that interview.
Yeah, that piece was done for a website called eMusic, which was a digital music delivery site that I knew the people who were editing it. And it was a great opportunity. I mean, I'd been a fan for a long time because, you know, when like Stiff started, you know, Lowe was like the kind of the non-mysterious figurehead, you know, in terms of artists. But Elvis was mysterious and elusive. You know, I mean, you know, Dave Schultz interviewed Elvis over the phone for the issue that's over your right shoulder. And, you know, like that was like, you know, really hard to do because Elvis was pretty inaccessible. Jake Riviera was very protective. You know, but Lowe kind of turned out to be sort of like the public face of Stiff in terms of being, you know, voluble and kind of like in it for fun, not for like image or you know, to be cool. He obviously produced a lot of the records and you know, made some of the best records and then went to Radar. So, you know, he was just somebody that was very easy for me to admire, you know, and enjoy. I mean, I liked the first couple of albums a ton. You know, they really hit those pleasure zones of like smart and funny and British and, you know, pop. You know, I mean, you know, the Jesus of Cool has just got great songs on it. You know, and then he became sort of like this kind of omnipresent figure as the, you know, the bass player in Rockpile and, you know, and in Rockpile and then, you know, playing with you know, he would sort of show up at Elvis shows from time to time, you know, and he'd open, you know, and then as producing like, you know, The Damned and everything, you know, and there was all these great legends going around that he'd speeded up The Damned's first album, you know, like, you know, just he'd roll the tape fast and stuff, which he denies. I think he said it was sulfates, not tape manipulation.
Yes, that's right. Very nicely. Last night I went to an art show, including work by an old friend of my family's, Suzanne Thomas, the ex-wife of Bruce Thomas, the Attractions. And I remember that in 2013, I went to see Elvis play a concert in Hyde Park. Nick was the support act. So backstage was really full of the sort of Stiff, you know, conglomerate. And Suzanne at that concert introduced me to the bride who used to rock and roll, which is a marvelous moment.
So the I've actual
met,
bride.
Yeah, so I've met the bride who used to rock and roll, which is a nice touch.
Yeah, I'm a great admirer of the guy, but like I think you said, Martin, I haven't rushed out and bought every Nick Lowe album. It's not really like that. You know, like I used to rush out and buy every Randy Newman album. And he does mention Randy Newman in that audio interview, funnily enough. So, but I realize there are a lot of songs by Nick that I really like.
Yes.
I'm just not exactly sure that other people haven't sung them better. And a real case in point would be like The Beast in Me. Johnny Cash's version is truly sort of kind of chilling in a way that Nick's really isn't, you know. But this, I mean, like on that album, At My Age, there's a fabulous song called The Other Side of the Coin, which is again sort of, it's got that kind of melancholy aging thing. And Solomon Burke did a fabulous version of that.
Yes.
I mean, of course, the most famous thing is, of course, there's the what's so funny about Peace, Love and Understanding that's on the Bodyguard soundtrack. The famous story that Nick came down in his slippers and dressing gown one morning, and on the mat inside the front door was an envelope, and inside the envelope was a check for $1 million. And I think that's actually true.
No, it is, because it was it was used in The Bodyguard, which became the biggest selling soundtrack up to
ever.
That point.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was only used over the end credits. It wasn't actually in the film. But being on the album.
Being on the album, exactly.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's a very interesting song, as Barney and I were talking about it earlier, that I remember as a sort of wannabe hippie in 1969, 1970 at school in London. And the amount of cynicism crept in around the whole sort of hippie scene. If you flashed a peace sign, you'd be mocked for weeks afterwards for doing that. And in a way, that song was actually a response to that, precisely that cynicism, which had sort of settled in. You know, it's a really lovely piece of songwriting. Yeah.
Yes.
Funny thing about Nick is, you know, after I did that interview, Will Birch wrote his biography of Nick, which I read. And, you know, Nick had always seemed kind of harmless to me, like sort of like a sweet fellow, good-natured, you know, and like Will's book, which is you know, a really beautifully done and fair-minded, you know, document, you know, paints him as kind of a horror in his early years, you know, like just a difficult, you know, self-indulgent, alcoholic loony, you know, and it's kind of like, didn't really register with the, you know, the way I'd always thought of him. And it took me a minute to kind of get over that, to sort of coalesce those two views and realize that he had been something, but that he wasn't that anymore. Because by the time I met up with him in 2007, he was like as gentle as a lamb. I mean, he was just soft-spoken and polite and, you know, self-effacing and charming, you know, like not at all the character who you would imagine from, you know, the Kippington Lodge era.
the Kippington Lodge years.
I mean, he went through that sort of grueling thing of like the Brinsley Schwartz's visit to America, which almost destroyed the band. And he probably just had to sort of like readjust himself, you know, just mm-hmm. to survive, you know. But
it's kind of proof that aging is actually a good thing.
And of course, Nick was the kind of mellow fellow in the Rykuda supergroup Little Village.
Indeed, another sort of notch on the bedpost.
Yeah,
but they were sort of very much less than the sum of their parts, weren't they, Little Village?
Yes.
I mean, I saw the show at Hammersmith Odeon very near here, and it was sort of one of the great non-events of my musical life.
Absolutely, wasn't it?
And I loved them all, do you know what
yes,
I mean?
Exactly.
I'm a big John Hyatt fan.
Yeah, we'd have crawled over hot coals to see that conglomerate.
I know.
And it wasn't good.
I have a vivid memory of interviewing John Hyatt in the hotel room, and he greeted me in his socks, which he was wearing clothes, but he also had socks on. I just thought that was kind of like...
It's
kind of relaxed. Very, very homey, I thought.
I mean, socks and nothing else would be worse than just nothing at all, wouldn't it, really?
Yeah.
That's the Red Hot
Chili
Peppers.
It's not an image. Yeah. And I just finally wanted, wanted to mention just, you know, we talked about his production. I mean, the very, in my memory, like literally the first punk record that I ever heard was New Rose by The Damned. Matt Snow, who I was sharing a flat with, had just bought New Rose. And he brought it in, he played it, and it was like this just incredible blast of energy. And then I kind of picked up the single and saw, you know, produced by Nick Lowe. And I, you know, to me, Nick was still sort of like Brinsley Schwartz, you know.
Pub rock.
And yeah, exactly. So, I mean, he's just got this really interesting little kind of nodes along the way in this career, aren't there? So it was just good to, and I suppose in a way, to sort of, Just to say, finally, he was an archetypal subject for Trouser Press, you know, as a British artist, but a British artist who revered American music. And you had him on the cover. That piece that I referred to earlier was a cover story for Trouser Press. So I'm really glad you sent us that audio, Ira. To sort of just, I guess, bring the Trouser Press story to some sort of conclusion, there came a night, and it happened to be 10 years after you launched the Transoceanic Trouser Press fanzine, when you decided to call it a day. You decided to have hold a kind of little wake, a kind of show, and to put the paper to bed, to wrap it up there. So to tell us what happened and why Trouser Press only lasted in that iteration, its print form, for 10 years.
There were a bunch of factors. The obvious ones were, you know, money and personal issues. And we were getting older, and I think we were getting kind of cynical and jaded a little bit. You know, I mean, the music that was in our sort of yard at that point was, you know, sort of new romantic and kind of like, you know, the Culture Club, Eurythmics, you know, Duran Duran pop music, which was fine. We liked it all, but we weren't crazy about it the way we did about, you know, the new wave bands of a few years earlier. And, you know, we sort of found ourselves being led into an area by the success of MTV that was sort of uncomfortable for us because, you know, MTV was doing what we were doing in terms of the artists because, of course, you know, British pop bands had videos and American bands didn't. So MTV was showing what they could get, which was all, you know, The Cure and Duran Duran and New Order and stuff like that. And we wanted to write about those bands because that was our brief, basically. But we didn't have the opportunity. We didn't have the facility to write about them with anywhere near as much, you know, three-dimensional value as MTV could have by showing their videos on TV. So, you know, we sort of felt like a little obsolete, you know, kind of like we'd been made a bit redundant by MTV, you know, which was good for the bands because, you know, MTV was a lot more beneficial to their careers than we could be. And so we sort of found ourselves a little bit like out in the wilderness in terms of that. Our audience evolved to being younger, which was a little weird for us because we were getting older and they were getting younger because of the bands. And it just sort of like felt like we'd been there and done that. You know, we were kind of like, as I think I said in the introduction to Zip It Up, you know, we kind of shifted from the, oh my God, this is so exciting. We've got, you know, all this space. We can do anything we want with to, holy crap, we've got a magazine to fill. What are we going to put in it each month?
Right.
You know, and so I spent about a year thinking about it, you know, about whether the magazine should continue. And then just finally came to the decision to knock it on the head. And so the 10th anniversary party was not technically a wake because no one knew it was the end of the magazine.
Okay.
Although rumors did circulate that night. it was just a way, you know, we just wanted to have a party basically to celebrate 10 years. It seemed like a good idea, but we had already decided to stop. And so, you know, the next morning we basically put out a press release saying, that's it, we're done. But it turned out to be very difficult to stop publishing a magazine, much harder than it was to start one. You know, we had to like, you know, pay off bills and collect money and, you know, deal with subscriptions and deal with our you know, all the crap we'd accumulated, all the photo files, the bio files, you know, all the unemployment issues. It was just a nightmare. It took more than 6 months to shut down the magazine.
Wow. Mm. Yeah.
So no, it's the message you never start a magazine because it'll be absolute hell winding it down.
Absolutely.
I know you got another party in a couple of days. Or in fact, by the time this episode comes out, it will be in the past. Yeah, it will have happened at Bowery Electric with former DBs Peter Holsapple and Chris Stamey. So just tell us briefly what happened on Saturday night. Imagine it's Monday morning.
Oh, it was great. Everything went perfectly well. We made a ton of money. We sold a lot of books. I got up and sang with Dennis Dyken. I'm going to sing I have sung Trouser Press with Dennis Dyken.
Oh, wonderful.
Great Roger Ruskin Spear song.
Okay, yeah. Fantastic. Great. I'm glad it was a great night.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm still getting over the hangover. I'm actually, Sunday night, I'm actually reading at Wesley Stace's Cabinet of Wonders at City Winery. So I promised him I would be there even if I had to like do it through a hangover. So we'll see how that goes.
No. Well, talking on the Thursday before the party, we wish you all the best success with that. I hope it's a really great night.
Thank you.
Let's also just talk about what you've done since Trouser Press came to a close in 84. You've had a lot of very like prestigious gigs. You were the critic at New York Newsday. You worked for MJI Broadcasting, a major radio network. So just tell us about the post Trouser Press years, which also of course include the record guides and lots of Trouser Press activity, just not the actual print magazine.
Right. Well, the continuity really was the record guides. You know, the first one came out before the magazine ended. You know, and it was our attempt to basically review every new wave album that existed, which at the time was almost feasible. You know, there was a moment when the number of albums that had come out was manageable. That quickly changed. But, you know, we did five volumes of that up through the 90s. And the last edition was because we'd been accumulating up till then. We'd been just, you know, augmenting each issue with new content. The fourth one was so big that the fifth one had to basically start from scratch. So what happened was, in order to be able to publish the fifth edition with none of the content from the fourth edition, I realized we needed a website to be able to post all of the previous content so that anyone that bought the fifth edition could then be sort of led back to what preceded it. So that was the impetus for creating the first Trouser Press website, which has gone through several iterations and is now, you know, more or less a slowly publishing music site, journalism site, which has all of the issues scanned with an index. It has all of the reviews from all of the record guides. It has a bunch of articles and a nice forum that people contribute to. So yeah, that's been sort of the continuity. You know, I went on to jobs at a video magazine, and then, as you said, at New York Newsday, and then I worked for a radio company, the one that MJI was bought by, which was iHeartRadio, for 20 some odd years, and retired from that in 2020, just as COVID was hitting, and became a book publisher. So Trouserbrush Books is now my retirement project, and I'm actually working a lot harder than I ever have been, which was kind of like kind of stupid.
Is that what you wanted? Is that what you wanted, Ira?
Yeah, well,
at my age,
at this age, yeah. No, I mean, but anyway, Trouserbrush Books is fun. I mean, it's kind of giving me an opportunity to be more of an editor than a writer, which is actually something that I enjoy. The world of small publishing has changed so much that it's much more feasible to do now than it was years ago. And you know, and I'm working with good people and having an interesting time of it. So yeah, I mean, we've done a bunch of books. Actually, Zip It Up was our 12th title. So Trouserbrush Books is off and running.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's been some great things there. The Arista book was fascinating for me. And we had Vernon Gibbs on the podcast not long after that book had come out. So it was really helpful to be able to talk to him about his Arista days. Okay. So I have a question. Were the Raspberries ever kind of embraced by Trouser Press? Because I know you had a sweet tooth for power pop, but were the Raspberries covered much in the magazine?
No, and not for any particular reason, but I think basically timing. I think, you know, we started in 74. Was there a lot of Raspberries success after that?
They probably, yeah, maybe the last Raspberries album would have, well, it's probably 75, wasn't it, the last album?
We definitely reviewed them.
No, I think it was early.
Was it earlier, 74?
Well, Eric Carmen had a band in 75, so I think they must have broken up by then.
Okay.
They were certainly on our radar, and we wrote about them. But I actually, you know, with the recent death of Carmen, I've had arguments with people about, you know, power pop fans argue about what is and what isn't power pop. And,
yes.
And I always had kind of a reservation about the Raspberries because their songs were like the Knacks, were concupiscent. And that to me is kind of a deal breaker for power pop. I mean, power pop to me has an intrinsic innocence, a kind of like a sort of, you know, the teenage, you know, teenagers standing against a wall at the high school dance, too afraid to ask the opposite sex to like go into the floor. You know, that's power pop for me, is kind of angst, you know, and the Raspberries were like, go all the way. You know, it's like, well, Intercourse seemed a little bit extreme for power pop. So I've always kind of had that kind of reservation about them.
That's very funny. I mean, I noticed that you have a power pop primer that you yourself wrote, which is also, again, included in Zip It Up. So you know you speak. But they'll always be power pop to me, and I love them. Martin, am I to understand that you have been affected by the death of Eric Carmen?
No, not well. No, it's just that at some point, like 20 years ago, I got a bootleg of Eric Carmen live at the Roxy.
Okay.
And it's a great record. I mean, it wasn't a record. It was just a bootleg. But it was a kind of great performance. I also something quite kind of liked about that kind of weird mix of, what was it, Rachmaninoff? He kept ripping off for different songs. And
yes. It's a guilty pleasure for me. I absolutely love the Raspberries. I think they're kind of, I don't know, 6 or 7 absolutely kind of classic records they made. I mean, I can remember. I think he's astonishing. And I'm an overnight sensation. Oh, my God.
That's a great record.
Go all the way. I mean, they're phenomenal records, I think. So I think he was rather brilliant. I was sort of dismayed to hear from someone yesterday. Maybe it's you, Mark, passing on some comment that Carmen ended his life not only having had sort of fairly radical work done on his face. He looked really freakish. But I think these two things do go hand in hand. Apparently he'd become full on MAGA by the end of his life.
Oh, God.
Which is sort of, it does go hand in hand with extreme plastic surgery, doesn't it, funnily enough? So I'm being very irreverent.
You heard it here first.
So we have lost Eric Carmen, and we also have lost Carl Wallinger of World Party, and we've lost Vince Power, who was a very charismatic, quite aggressive Irish promoter on the live music scene in this country, festivals and clubs, the Mean Fiddler. I mean, you guys must have been to the Mean Fiddler more than once.
Yeah, absolutely.
I went many times.
No,
where he establishes his power base.
I like the Mean Fiddler. He ruined what was the town and country when he turned it into the Forum. Right. It became a significantly less nicer place to see bands after he took over. There's a lot of mixed feelings about him. On the one hand, he's quite brilliant. On the other hand, he's a pretty ruthless operator.
Yeah.
Lost his shirt a few times on projects, which went very badly wrong, festival projects particularly. But, you know, at a time when, you know, putting on bands was something that people desired to do, he did it generally pretty well. And I like the Mean Fiddler very much as a venue.
As for World Party, I mean, I see there's been a sort of some outpouring of grief for the death of Carl Wallinger. I believe I have a memory of seeing World Party, funnily enough, at the Town and Country. And sorry to say, I found it so deeply underwhelming.
Yeah. I mean, interestingly enough, so on my Facebook feed, the people mourning him the most are my American music journalist friends.
Yes.
Whilst actually most of my English music journalist friends are just basically shrugging their shoulders and saying, kind of, so what?
Well, I know, so what is probably the wrong response to somebody dying, but I just couldn't
have,
I couldn't really get the fuss that was sort of initially made of World Party. They were sort of very much of their time, but it just seemed flavourless to me. Did you ever see them, Martin, or listen to them?
No, I never did. No.
So anyway, those are some of the people who've gone in the last week or so. Mark, do you have any pieces that you want to tell us about? At this point, Ira, if Mark talks about a piece, say he was to quote from a review of The Who Sell Out in 1968, you might want to jump in and say, I agree or I disagree. So feel free to jump in. But Mark's just going to tell us what's caught his attention.
Yeah, just a few things. Penny Valentine interviewing Charlie Watts for Disc for 1964. And he says, it's about, you know, he was a designer he was a professional designer before he became a permanent drummer of the Rolling Stones. He said, I used to turn up at the flat being Edith Grove, I'd guess, with all my graphic equipment in this sharp case and my very sharp clothes on, and ask if there's anything doing with the group that evening. That was when I was first with them. And as there was, I'd leave all my stuff. They thought that was very funny. Of course, I got chucked out of my job when I played for them full time. It's a very nice interview, you know. And Penn is like delving into the Charlie Watts, who's more than just a Rolling Stones drummer.
Yeah.
What else have we got here? A certain Woz brother, if I can get my bits of paper in order. Yes, David Woz to Sean Passenden. Don and I are firmly against the dolphin thing. You know about killing dolphins when you fish for tuna? Well, it's good. The ozone there, it's got to go. You can tan better without ozone. Rainforests, wood is wood. They can always make furniture out of plastic. You don't really need wood. Hairspray's good. It's got to have an aerosol propellant in it, or I don't use it. And so on and so forth. Now, we recently inherited to lovely Johnny Black his archive of magazines, and amongst them was a thing called Pop Star Pictorial, undated magazine, 1964. And it's a study about rhythm and blues. This is coming in this week. And it opens with, rhythm and blues? What's that then? I asked the square in the coffee bar, settling the lapels of his double-breasted suit and checking that his parting was straight in the reflection, rolled around the espresso machine. R&B, why, it's the latest, cried the mod girl. It's the greatest, echoed her boyfriend, tipping his thin brim hat even further over forward over his eyes and flicking a piece of fluff off his scooter jacket. It's all right, admitted a rocker, chiselling the mud away from his boots with a clasp knife he kept in the pocket of his ton-up leathers. But what is it? What is this R&B, asked the square. Rhythm and blues, they all cried. This is about the British R&B boom. It's a lovely piece. Oh, yes, and lastly, Danny Goldberg, going back to his days of being the publicity guy for the Kiss, he says, for 8 months I had the privilege of handling the publicity for Kiss and found to be, I hope you don't mind me saying this, the nicest rock stars I'd ever worked with. Not too nice, just human beings without egos the size of baseball stadiums they were performing in. It's a very nice piece. That's it.
Hard to imagine if Gene Simmons, I mean, no one's ever accused Gene Simmons of being egoless.
You know, we have two letters. Gene was a subscriber to Trouser Press in the very early days. And there's two letters from him that we received in the book, in Zip It Up, responding to articles that we'd written. And he's like a real record nerd. You know, like he's a full-on, like, you know, fan of obscure music. And he's like arguing with people about stuff. It's really great.
Fantastic.
The revelation that Gene Simmons isn't a monster we always thought he was. So, yeah. Barney, have you got anything?
I haven't had time to cobble anything together. It's been a fairly mad week, partly because Jasper's been in Los Angeles attending PopCon, the pop conference at USC Thornton. So we're looking forward to his return, finding out what adventures he got up to there. I know he went to see Tom Vickers, the former Minister of Information for P-Funk, to look at all Tom's amazing, like, George Clinton memorabilia. And I believe he also heard George Clinton being interviewed by Daniel Smith on Friday night at PopCon and said it was wonderful. What else could it possibly be?
Absolutely.
So we are at the end of this episode. Thank you so much for joining us, Ira. Do go out and buy all of Ira's books, particularly Zip It Up, The Best of Trouser Press Magazine, 1974 to 1984. If you're in New York, be at the Bowery Electric on Saturday night or be square. and we will be back in 2 weeks with none other than our friend Sean O'Hagan, not the writer, but the leader of the High Llamas, the highest of the llamas. Sean O'Hagan will be joining us to talk about their new album, Hey Panda, and everything High Llamas have done. I adore the High Llamas. Do also have a look at Rocks Back Pages itself. If you are a university or a member of a public library that doesn't subscribe, suggest they take a free trial of the world's largest archive of music journalism. And on that note, we're going to say, what are we going to say, guys?
Goodbye.
That concludes episode 173 of the Rocks Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Ira Robbins. Zip It Up, The Best of Trouser Press Magazine, 1974 to 1984, is published by Trouser Press Books and available now via trouserpressbooks.com. The hosts were Barney Hoskins, Mark Pringle, and Martin Collier, and the producer was Jasper Murison Bowie. The Rocks Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.